SCP-9341, Containment Breach Capacity, Part 1. Things can and will go wrong at pretty much any business, establishment, or organization involving humans, regardless of how many precautions or protocols are put into place. Humans are fallible, for a myriad of reasons, and while the chance for failure can be mitigated and reduced, it's never zero. Failure at a Foundation site, however, often carries far more devastating consequences than failure at your local Taco Bell. Containment breaches are a hallmark of the Foundation universe, a monumental failure on the Foundation's part to do the one thing they're sworn to do, which is secure, contain, and protect. These breaches can range from one harmless anomaly not being where it should be, to cascading failures that result in the end of the world, or worse. SCP-9341 is about one such breach, and while it doesn't seem to have resulted in the end of the world, some very fishy things occurred at this Foundation site. Let's take a look. SCP-9341 is Site CB, a facility subordinate to Site-19. It was originally a research facility, but had to take up containment duties past its expected limits as a response to the fracturing raids. After an incident, it turned into SCP-9341. The facility is causally inconsistent, with its state dependent on both specific trigger actions by personnel and on an as-of-yet poorly understood process. The primary trigger is interaction with the gate entryways to the facility. It will remain intact when entering from Gate A, and appears destroyed when entering from Gate B. For all intents and purposes, the facility serves as two separate but interconnected locations, each assigned a distinct purpose, per O5 instructions. SCP-9341-A is Benjamin Oliver Walker, formerly designated as D-9341, a focal point of the anomaly. We're then given a choice between entering Gate A, containing documents about the investigation of the incident that required reclassification as 9341, and Gate B, containing documents about the aftermath of the incident and the anomaly's future. Let's start with A, then. We're given another description for 9341, this time with the object class of Archive. It states that 9341 entered through Gate A is Site CB after the peaceful conclusion of a site-wide containment breach. The breach lasted an indeterminable amount of time before MTF Epsilon-11 managed to recontain the site's anomalies and take control of all site systems back from SCP-079. The only surviving instigator of the containment breach, excluding the Chaos Insurgency at large. SCP-079 is a microcomputer built in 1978 that achieved sentience, and is generally angry at its imprisonment by the Foundation. During the breach, Walker was able to be contained 95% of the time, but several anomalies were able to escape the facility and subsequently spread the anomalous condition among multiple settlements in the region. While it cannot fully be confirmed, this fact is assumed to correspond with the Gate B version of the facility. Site CB is subject to several causal inconsistencies, extending to all aspects of the site, spatial and temporal. The most common occurrence is the displacement of documents and equipment to random locations around the site, which can be traced back to different actions Walker took during the breach, on his way to escape to the surface zone. In other words, the day of the breach is under constant retrocausal revision caused by Walker. It's suspected that the breach was intended as the crowning achievement of the fracturing raids by the Chaos Insurgency. It's unclear if this outcome of SCP-9341 was the intended goal or not, however. Hard to tell when the group is literally called the Chaos Insurgency. Due to the critical nature of the incident, an investigation has been conducted by an O5, with conclusions of the investigation divided into two parts. Here we see a couple of interesting things about the unique format of this article. One is that the documents occasionally feature handwritten notes in the margin from someone, this one pointing out that only the conclusions are stored here, not the full files. The other unique thing is that various documents throughout the article require different clearance levels, and there are also different versions of the same documents at different clearance levels, redacting certain bits of information. Since clearance level 4 is the highest, let's stick with that as much as we can, and check on the findings on the incident. There were two instigators responsible for the breach, both of whom worked for the Chaos Insurgency. First was security agent Skinner, who is still at large, although he was potentially terminated by SCP-106, a highly dangerous humanoid entity capable of spreading a corrosion effect and pulling people into a pocket dimension. Skinner's name and occupation do not correspond to any known Foundation personnel, and he's suspected to be a Chaos Insurgency asset responsible for multiple intelligence breaches, with a personal grudge against the Foundation due to the occupation of Nexus 59, a small town in Missouri where anomalous activity was treated as commonplace by the residents prior to Foundation involvement. The other individual is Dr. George Maynard, who was terminated by 106 during the events of the breach. He worked at the Foundation for 29 years, and it's possible that he became a double agent for the insurgency after his daughter became victim to a cognitohazard, and he was prevented from administering a Clearance 4 counteragent to her over an insecure landline. The handwritten note here states that Maynard was respected among his peers, and the reason for his fall needs more detail than a footnote. Dr. Maynard started to sabotage the site via the Modular Site Project, a redesign of the facility to accommodate the increased load of anomalies it had to deal with as a result of the fracturing raids. The project resulted in a labyrinthine site, confusing to navigate for personnel and anomalies alike, heightening the chaos during the breach. Agent Skinner's only action was the release of SCP-106 during his containment shift. And while site security was occupied with that, Dr. Maynard gained access to SCP-079's containment unit. He provided the anomaly with a way to control most of the site's systems, particularly the door control system. Maynard then returned to his office, and all evidence points towards him having been abducted by 106 in the early phase of the breach. The containment breach proper started with a door malfunction in the SCP-173 containment chamber during a scheduled cleaning. 173 is a humanoid statue that can only move when it's not being directly looked at which point it moves rapidly to kill by the snapping of necks or strangulation. Walker was part of the D-class cleaning crew and remained ignored by 173 while it killed several guards stationed next to the chamber, as well as the rest of the cleaning crew. At this point, 079 exerted its full control over the doors, electricity, and monitors, facilitating the breach of multiple hostile SCP objects, roughly guided towards any remaining personnel in the facility. The exact actions of Walker remain in constant shift, though there are a few consistent facts. Walker lifted the lockdown in the light containment and the heavy containment zone and made his way to the entrance zone. He was able to clear the checkpoints by continually upgrading his clearance level through the finding of key cards stolen from dead researchers or found on shelves, as well as upgrading the level of the key card via SCP-914, a large clockwork device capable of modifying anything inserted into it. MTF Epsilon-11 entered the facility and detected a free-running D-class, but were unable to terminate Walker. At minimum, he deactivated the remote door control system in the entrance zone, entered the 079 containment chamber in the heavy containment zone, reactivated the remote door control system, entered the 079 containment chamber a second time, and made his way to the gates. He then either entered Gate A or Gate B, determined as the branching point of the two main causalities of SCP-9341. In this version of the facility, he tried to exit via Gate A, and 95% of the time was apprehended by Epsilon-11 and subsequently contained. Epsilon-11 continued sweeping the facility and recontained all remaining anomalies. An escape attempt by 079 via radio transmission was noted and stopped through active jamming on all channels until 079 was disconnected from the facility and all systems rebooted. When it was later questioned why it tried its escape attempt after most anomalies had already been recontained, it seemed momentarily distressed at a possible logic fault in itself, before ceasing all communication. In the 5% where Walker was not contained, Epsilon 11 was instead distracted by SCP-106. Walker used this opportunity to escape to an old service tunnel and vanished into thin air. The pursuing MTF soldiers were subsequently trapped in the tunnel, both entrances replaced with solid stone. We're then given a few more document choices, but let's continue with the Clearance Level 4 stuff, and look at the interview with Assistant Director Moose of Site-19. She's asked by her interviewer, an O5, what her association with Site-CB was, but she says she didn't have one. She's Assistant Director to Site-19, and Site-CB only had to answer to Site Director Strelnikov, so she's confused as to why she's being interrogated about this. The O5 replies that, since Strelnikov is just an interim site director and close to retirement, they decided to interview her in his stead for internal reasons and as a training opportunity for the candidate most likely to replace him. They ask what was the directorship's association with Site-CB, but she says very little. Site-19 doesn't dictate, only guides its many sectors and associated facilities. That's why they have so many assistant directors. Facility 23 had been practically untouched for years before SCP-914 had to be transferred to Site-CB. They ask why Site-CB was chosen to handle a containment overload, to which she says that due to Site-19's condition, only facilities considered a part of 19 could be regarded, which narrowed down their choices significantly. She's asked what her relationship to Site Director Rosewood is, but she never spoke to the man. As for Strelnikov, the site director kept in contact with him, but she wasn't privy to those conversations. Rosewood managed a facility conducting Level 5 classified research, so she believes he was given more leeway in his operations. After the transfers, Strelnikov talked mainly with Security Chief Franklin. She's met Franklin, as his security concepts had to be approved by Site-19 directorship. His original concepts seemed fitting for the situation, and he came with approval from the counterinsurgency commander. The O5s ask if the modular site project ever crossed her or her director's desk. She says that only when it was considered for wider Foundation adoption, as Site-19 already fulfilled part of its objectives, such as the labyrinthian design. She does note that the containment breach has caused a minor commotion in Strelnikov's site, as a lot of researchers knew Walker. His previous assignment was secret enough, but incidents like these always carry beyond what is possible to hide. The O5 replies that review of his disciplinary case is of little concern, as the employee retention policy is limited by SCP classification. She's aware, but 19 houses many overeager researchers who might see an injustice in this case. The O5 asks her how the repairs are going, and she says that they should be finished ahead of schedule. The O5 declares that she is not at fault for this incident, and she did follow protocol. They will grant her her place of power, and they tell her to ensure it stays orderly. The handwritten note remarks that there doesn't seem to be an interview with Rosewood here. We next move on to the interview with Security Chief Franklin, and the O5 asks why the site's layout looks different compared to when they first visited it. They visited after the modular site project was implemented, and the rooms are arranged in a different way now. Franklin just replies that he has no idea, as it's always been like this. He's asked what his role was in Site-CB, to which he says that he joined as security chief to deal with containment overload after the raid of Site-19. As for his relationship with Director Rosewood, they come from very different backgrounds. They agreed early on that Rosewood would leave his hands off containment, and he'd leave him to what little the site did for research. Franklin had few resources, and knew from the start that they didn't have enough to keep the site from blowing up. All he could focus on was mitigation, and that they achieved. The O5 asks if three major regional incidents, one of which is still uncontained, sound mitigated to him. But Franklin argues that that was attributed to Gate B, and they can't forget Maynard's role in this. The O5 asks if he didn't vouch for Maynard's plans, but Franklin says that everyone did. Maynard was a trusted researcher, even by the O5s. The O5 concludes the interview, telling him that he will be the new site director of this version of the facility, ensuring everything in this version stays as it is. Franklin argues that he followed protocol, so they can't do this to him. He suspects that this is because of the other version of him, the one that nuked the site, but the O5 replies that site director is a promotion. He complains that they can't keep him locked here, as the people left in the site have been replaying petty grudges on a loop. The O5 states that this cycle has been reported as part of SCP-9341, and for his purposes, this behavior should be encouraged. Franklin argues that it's not a damn cycle, as it's the same grudges, but they keep deepening. They can't keep people trapped underground and expect them to continue functioning. They are all feeling the tension, and it's only a matter of time before it explodes. The O5 replies that it's the site director's job to keep their people in line, unless he considers himself not up to the task. Franklin says that no, he'll gladly take the job, and thanks them for the opportunity. The handwritten note at the bottom says that the state of the people here really does need addressing, and they can't be solved by a director just as affected by this suffocating space. Let's next look at the Chaos Insurgency's involvement here, checking out the Fracturing Raids. The raids constitute the latest in a series of the Insurgency's strange attractor events. Most of the Insurgency's activities are restricted to a few cells or radicalized individuals acting out, but in a strange attractor event, they see a majority of cells, otherwise not above attacking each other, align in purpose and coordinate targeted actions to accomplish a multifaceted goal. This goal often remains unclear, even in the immediate aftermath of the event. Think of it sort of like an Orc Wog, but featuring the Chaos Insurgency against the Foundation. While signs of a coming event have been identified retrospectively, predicting it remains next to impossible, although a component of the event will always include premonition-guided orders given by the Chaos Insurgency Delta Command. It's unclear how much of the event can be attributed to these orders, and how much to an emergent desire among cells to act out their long-term radicalization. A majority of strange attractor events have been Foundation-focused, with rare exceptions like the factory expulsion or the stand against the soiling craft. The last confirmed strange attractor event resulted in the neutralization of SCP-3000, the giant eel where the Foundation got their strongest amnestics, and interim Foundation dependence on the US government and its Bow Commission. Insurgency actions during the 2008 funding crisis have been discussed, but ultimately deemed compounding instead of causing the crisis. It has therefore not been classified as a strange attractor event. This makes the Fracturing Raids the first strange attractor event since Incident Zero and the dispersion of the Bow Commission. They constituted a worldwide attack on Foundation facilities during 2012, the intensity and number of raids increasing significantly in the Foundation Operational Core, North America. The handwritten note here remarks that the wording implies a larger scale than it was, as 90% of raids consisted of three people at best. The Insurgency was at no time able to field an army. The goal of each individual raid was singular, with some focusing on killing Foundation personnel, and others on the kidnapping of D-Class or the completion of cell and location-specific goals. A subset of facilities could not continue their containment duties due to destruction caused by the raids, and Site-19 was available to temporarily take on an overload of anomalies. Concerns about the site's unique effect on anomalies contained by it were overruled by O5 Command. While a counteroffensive was initiated, Site-19 was attacked by the largest of the Fracturing Raids, completely focused on damaging as many containment apparatus as possible. At the time, this was thought to be an esoteric attack on the site's anomalous properties, but the main purpose has since been determined to cause an overload of containment in a site ill-equipped to handle it. Site CB at this time had only been used to outhouse a few research projects of Site 19, chief among them causality-related research, including Project Spiral Gestalt. Site CB was chosen to take on the containment overload due to its small distance to Site 19's current location, and counting as an extension of Site 19, thereby bypassing procedure about Site 19 anomalies contained at other sites. Reconstruction of all affected facilities began, and the counteroffensive was able to find half of the insurgency bases responsible for the raids, a further half of them deserted. The rest were destroyed, their anomalies secured, and their personnel terminated. The containment breach of Site CB is currently assumed as the primary goal of this strange attractor event, due to it causing the creation of Nexus 35, the Blaka 1 crisis, SCP-9341-A, and something unassigned. We're also provided a primer on the insurgency, which states that it's the successor of an organization that split apart from the Foundation in 1924 due to irreconcilable differences about the Veil and the usage of anomalies, resulting in the Foundation Civil War, won in 1926. The insurgency is mainly organized in cells, making a clear origin of the organization difficult. The Foundation Civil War serves as the strongest observed impetus for severance from the Foundation. Cells are not necessarily fully aware of the wider insurgency, but the majority of them are united in hate for the Foundation and its mission. The core of the insurgency and the cells that make it up are in constant flux, causing the group to have ideological drift into different directions over the years. While this core is somewhat guided by Delta Command, this central authority is no less immune to abrupt change than the rest. In other words, the Chaos Insurgency is fairly chaotic. Who would have thought? The most drastic changes happen after Foundation forces have cracked down on existing insurgency structures, or after the original end of the world in 1976, when cells fell into infighting about what to do after they temporarily reduced the Foundation to a point it had difficulty to act. The latter also served as the last confirmed appearance of the Engineer, the at times alleged leader of Delta Command. The current makeup of the insurgency has been strongly influenced by the end of the Bow Commission, many supporters of which fled to the insurgency. They formed the Boist faction, excessively focused on the weaponization of anomalies, and likely the as-of-yet strongest military wing of the insurgency. Together with Burners, a collection of cells single-mindedly focused on destruction, and a few Legitimists, an attempt to rebuild a Foundation-like organization in the insurgency, the Boists form the current core of the insurgency, all led by Delta Commander Damian O'Connor, who has forced the cells under his command into a war of attrition against the Foundation. The fracturing raids were thought of originally as a continuation of this pattern. However, only the interim states, not the end result, are coherent as military objectives. Thinking of the current state of 9341 as the intended goal is much more in line with thinking expected from the Ascensionist faction, the faction assumed most closely aligned with the Engineer. We're also provided some info about insurgency agents, whose danger lie not in their gun, but in their pockets. It's to be assumed that the insurgent is always armed with at least one anomaly, and a willingness to use it regardless of effect on his allies. The insurgent is likely to additionally carry a random assortment of non-anomalous equipment ranging from a jar of bees to state-of-the-art lockpicking tools. The document also warns about any insurgent injecting themselves with a red drug, as the red site serves as an amplifier for completion of the Engineer's plan, and will turn even the most harmless insurgent into an overzealous superhuman. Insurgents in this state are not to be engaged, excluding designated MTFs. Recruitment of agents for the insurgency happens through many vectors, but a notable commonality lies in D-Class, who often end up holding a grudge against the Foundation, making them easy victims of radicalization by insurgency recruiters. To counteract the benefits the insurgency may gain from recruiting D-Class, both D-Class communal activities and information cleared for D-Class personnel have been further restricted. Many sides have additionally started to insert double agents into the D-Class pool in attempts to be recruited. We're also given the current logo of the insurgency, which looks to be a skewed and distorted version of the Foundation logo. View of this logo carries a cognitohazardous effect of forcing any negative memory the viewer associates with the Foundation to the front of their mind, regardless of how minor the negative association. The logo serves as further explanation of why D-Class are easily turned into insurgents, with the presence of the logo amplifying any grudges held by the person. The Central Memetics Department is working on a visual cognitohazard able to instantly counteract the logo, but until then, a mental reprimand of all the good the Foundation does and its role in keeping the world stable has proven as an effective counteragent. If the effect proves stronger, personnel should remember the Foundation's mission statement, speak it aloud 3 times, and internalize its meaning. If the effect does not abate after the previous treatment, the patient is to seek out their nearest ethics committee liaison to air their grievances. The liaison will help the patient understand the ethical calculus applied by the Foundation and emphasize the net benefit that Foundation actions have on humanity. The patient must not forget that the Foundation serves for the greater good. Yeah, I'm sure a D-Class's nearest ethics committee liaison will be happy to help them out with their grudge against the Foundation. We're then provided an interview between an O5 and D-1025, with the interview being conducted during an entanglement breach, as normally 1025 has been used as a lure subject by Walker to contain SCP-106. He's asked if he had contact with Walker, but he says not really, as he was part of the other D group, the ones they treat better, the ones that don't get sent in as cannon fodder to die for stuff. They're all the same on paper, but you can tell who belongs to the better group. The O5 states that this is incorrect, as there is no preferential treatment among D-Class. 1025 isn't convinced, as that's why they get cleaning duty while he gets the old man. When asked how he felt during the breach, he says that he was pissed, as Walker was free to run around while he was just stuck in that cage for all of it. He guesses that opportunity only comes to you once. The way he sees it, there are really only 2 ways you can escape a prison. Outside help, and there the outside is doing the heavy lifting, or opportunity. The Foundation likes to pride itself on their perfect security systems, but all it takes is a driver taking a nap during a transfer, and a door that could be better locked, and you're free. The O5 asks if he's speaking from personal experience, but he says that he didn't take it. He thought they'd find him for sure, or the driver would wake up. Someone else wasn't as cowardly as him, and he never saw him again. The O5 asks if Walker didn't have outside help while escaping then, and 1025 says that it sure seemed that way. 1025 then realizes that he didn't make it out, and he died. He's still in there, and SCP-106 is killing him in its labyrinth. That's how he's doing this interview, because it's out. He asks the O5 to contain it, and he'll do tests, he'll do anything, to avoid going back to that place. The O5 simply replies that it's either him or 3 good soldiers, and the moral calculus is easy. The handwritten note remarks that D-1025 and the MTF team sent into the tunnel are clearly also affected by the entanglement breach, but information about them is missing. They wonder where D-1025 is contained during entanglement, as the policy cannot just be "don't let 106 breach containment." Next, we have an interview with the anesthesiologist responsible for Walker. They're asked what kind of amnestic they used, and they say that it wasn't eel stuff, as that's way too rare now. They didn't use the Site-19-specific amnestization program either, as it has the tendency to take out more than they want for subjects who are working at 19 for years. So just the new standard amnestic, and replaced with Death Row Memories Regiment. They're asked if those amnestics are fallible, and they state that they are, and while they take great pains to get every memory of the Foundation scrubbed as clean as possible, it's possible to reassert memories by exposing a patient to objects and places associated with those memories. This is why they always recommend changing the environment of a patient post-amnestization, which did not occur with Walker. As far as they're aware, though, he never came into contact with the section handling his prior research. They're asked if they believe he regained his memories during the breach, but it's hard to say. They sometimes find objects lying around that might trigger a memory recovery, but they cannot tell if it would have been enough. They'd have to speak with Walker to know for sure. Before the interview concludes, they note that a lot of the staff in this site have been complaining about falsely induced memories, brief flashes of differences that don't fit the site they know all that much. They think one was convinced that the site was called Ark Site 48, and they all came to the anesthesiologist to request amnestics, but they don't deal them out for minor stuff like this. They ask the O5 to maybe send a memeticist down there to look into it, and the O5 replies that they'll note it down. The handwritten note at the bottom remarks that there's missing details, if this is the anesthesiologist of a Site CB, or one on the payroll of the interviewing O5 personnel. We're next given a pretty big ticket item, an interview with Walker himself. When clicking on it, however, we're shown a security gate, and told that to enter the SCP-9341-A observation chamber, where the related interview is stored, all personnel must first add the date at which they entered the chamber. The handwritten note remarks that if there are concerns about breaking causal containment, then this interview should not be stored in the adjacent chamber. The document is also still advertised as SCP-9341-A interview in other files. Let's go ahead and put in the current date then, at which point we're taken to a very short document. Walker was originally planned as the last subject to be interviewed before concluding the O5 investigation into Site CB. This interview was abruptly cancelled, and causal isolation was implemented for Walker. A communication between two redacted individuals features them discussing him. One states that they don't know yet if he remembers, but the other says that it doesn't matter, as he's it. They want full no contact, and they ask how he is in Gate B, to which the other person says that he's dead. They got all possibilities, and they really did their best here, considering what they were facing. There's only the entanglement. The other individual says that they only need to keep the old man on a leash, while the other says that there's still an avenue of research here. They reply that the project failed, and the only saving grace is that this is the first time they have a host in containment. They tell the other to wrap this up, and maybe they return in a few years when their grip on this has increased, but this is it for now. They have their full authority on this, and they want this buried. We're then told that by order of the Overseer Council, SCP-9341 and all associated files are to be archived. Personnel stationed in Gate A are to act in accordance with the containment procedures indefinitely. The SCP-9341 investigation is declared closed. Alright, well, if you're anything like me, you're thoroughly confused by all this mess at this point. All we really know is that the Chaos Insurgency was involved in causing a breach at this site, which resulted in the place being entangled between two different versions of itself, one where it got nuked, and one where it didn't. The version we looked at, through Gate A, features the place still intact, but all of the personnel are caught in some sort of causal loop, but they're aware of it. We know one specific individual is key here, a former researcher turned D-class named Walker, who died in the nuked version, but is still alive in the other version. While we'd love to get more information about him, ideally from the man himself, the O5s want to bury the entire thing and forget about it. Obviously, there's no hiding the fact that this article is based on a pretty popular SCP game called Containment Breach, with Walker being apparently the main character. I don't think knowledge of the game is really necessary to understand the article, which is good because I haven't played it. We still have Gate B to look at in Part 2, and I don't think we're quite done with Gate A either, but we'll have to see how exactly all of these pieces fit together.